While you all have your books handy, there was one thing that we wanted to say about the song on page 23. I hope that some of you at least have noticed that in the back of the book there are very brief biographical sketches or notes about the person who authored the text. And for those of you who are interested in such things, I think it's interesting to see approximately when a song was written and in what country it was written. And you can go on from there and learn more about what the song means when you figure out what was going on at the time in the place among the people. But at any rate, the song on page 23 is one for which we did not provide an author's note. And because it has a lot to do with a young man and young people, I just want to make sure that all of you know it. Now, the boys who were not off on, well, 2 days ago, whatever, Monday, should know this already, so this should be a review for you. I should ask you to do this, actually, shouldn't I, Dan? All right, so Herbert Kirk White was a young man who was a very promising poet. I don't know if any of you aspire to write poetry, but in the 19th century, if you were at Oxford or Cambridge, you had a chance to study with and read the poetry of some of the greatest English poets that have been alive in the modern period. They were alive then, they were teaching, they were writing. And this young man was, Herbert Kirk White, was very gifted, and they were encouraging him, some of the poets of the day, the poet laureate of England, and other famous poets. And this poem that we have here before us as a hymn, which became a hymn, was written in part when he was a student, and then he suddenly took ill and died, all very, very quickly. Young man, promising career ahead of him, poems sketched out, one or two stanzas done, and then lines of his thoughts for the next stanzas. And then his life was just cut short. And so what happened was his friends, when they went through his papers, found this manuscript. And they were so taken by his thoughts in the first stanzas that they thought, in tribute to him, they would complete the poem. So this is one of the hymns in the book. It may be the only one, I think it is, that has multiple authors, where several people came together in tribute to the original author to complete his work. So there's no story for that in the back of the book, so that's your story, okay? I'm going to focus a little bit more tonight on the very first song that we have here. And we'll come back to the text of the song toward the end of what I'm going to say. But there are just two or three things I'd like to say first before we look at that particular text. So I'd like to talk just a little bit about the whole concept of pilgrim as American Christians typically understand it, and where it comes from. And that, I hope, will just take me a very few minutes and will give you, will prod your memories and prompt you to think about some things that you already know. And then I'll talk just a little bit more about the word pilgrim and what pilgrim has meant in Christianity more generally, and then we'll come back to this text, because this text is really extremely rich, and most of you will be back in school in a few weeks, as will I. So we're going to look at it as a student would look at a poem in an English class and discover the riches of the form and the rhyme and the language and the meaning that we can by just looking very briefly at a very short poem. But for most of us, our concept of pilgrim is shaped at least in part by a very famous book that everybody who comes to Pilgrim Camp has heard about at some point or other. Or if you work in the palace with me, if you look at the wall, you may not. I admit, I don't always read what's on the wall. But there are excerpts from this book, and there are paintings or murals and photographs and things that depict various scenes. And of course, it's Pilgrim's Progress. Pilgrim's Progress, next to the Bible, is probably the most influential English language book that was ever written. And the English-speaking colonists who came to this country in the 16 and 17 and 1800s carried that book with them. That and the Bible, in days when you might only own one or two or no more than 10 books, and 100 books was a huge library, Pilgrim's Progress was pretty standard. People owned this book. And they used it and the language that Bunyan gave them to help each other understand what their Christian lives were all about. And the third book in that, in a trio of books, of course, would have been Fox's Book of Martyrs, the stories of the Protestants who suffered under the Reformation, well, the changing Reformation leadership in England, and then expanded out to talk about suffering in the lives of Christians more generally. But at any rate, those three books were the big three for English-speaking Protestants. They really shape the way American Christianity understands the Christian life, the Catholic Church, if you will, too. Fox's Book of Martyrs pretty much shapes the way Protestants understood that church for a long time. And all of these books influence the way that we speak English and the phrases that we use. I'll give everybody who comes through the kitchen tomorrow a hint. If you look at the wall between the freezer and the cooler and read the brown plaque that's up there, it's a little long. When you get toward the end of it, you'll find a phrase that's a popular phrase that is alive in our language today. Don't tell them, Brother Tom. I heard that. Because John Bunyan made it live. So anyway, these are important books. And so let's just, I hope that all of you have read Pilgrim's Progress. I suspect that that's just a hope when I look at some of my friends like Jacob. Have you read Pilgrim's Progress, Jacob? Tell me the truth. Just between you and me, you watched the movie. All right, that, I knew somebody was going to tell me that. Or the next answer I expect, I won't call on the next person I think this answer might come from, would be that somebody read an abridged version or had a children's version with interesting pictures, pages you turned. I challenge you actually to read the book. All right. It would be a good assignment for you over the next year in preparation for coming back to camp, because it would help you to understand how Protestant English-speaking Christians embrace the notion of what it meant to be a pilgrim. All right, I'm going to tell you a little bit about that very quickly. Of course, the book was written by John Bunyan. John Bunyan lived from, this is the boring history part, so just, it'll pass. Stay away. 1628 to 1688. That means, in short, that he lived through some very tumultuous times. He lived through the decapitation of the king. He lived through civil wars. He lived through the recalling of another king. He lived through changing laws that had a lot to do with freedom of religion. And actually, he came to understand Christianity outside of the established church. If you belonged to the church that the state endorsed and the state supported, it was fairly easy to be a Christian because you were under the guidance of pastors who were trained, who supported the government, who did what the king said. And the parliament had a say in how the worship was ordered, and it was all supervised by the government. And particularly after the civil wars and after the king was killed and after there was all kinds of unrest, there was a lot of fear of congregations that didn't conform, because they would be places where new revolution might foment, where new ideas against the government, new opposition to authority might thrive. And so they tried to put down some of these smaller groups of Christians that met in homes and outdoors and schoolhouses outside the churches. And John Bunyan came to faith in such a place. And he joined a Baptist church when the state church was Episcopalian, as we would call it here, or Anglican, as they called it in England. And so that meant that for preaching outside of certain very restricted areas, he was actually arrested and put into prison twice. If you preached, if you weren't Church of England and you preached publicly, you could be arrested. If you were a Puritan, which many of the Baptists had been part of the Puritan movement, people who had risen up against the king and the authority of the king for religious and political reasons, if you were one of them, you weren't allowed to preach within 10 miles of a city. Because they were so afraid that if you preached to a big population, you might become an agitator who would endanger the peace. So he was very restricted, and apparently if you gave out a tract, if you preached on the street corner, if you did things outside the very small area of license that was given to nonconformists, you could be arrested and put into prison. And so he spent years of his life, 12 years more at one time and other months at other times, for violating the laws, mostly having to do with preaching the gospel and sharing his faith, not for other reasons. And during one of those imprisonments, he was writing the story of his salvation, his spiritual journey. And during that time, he began to think about something more general than what that individual story was. How to make this into every man's story. There used to be, in his day in England still, there were every man plays. There were public entertainments where there was a general story to which the audience could relate in particular ways. And you know, how do you take the story of your faith and, if you will, depersonalize it and generalize it so that other people are gathered in? And he sets aside the work, another work that he was writing, and begins to rethink how to tell the story of his faith. And what he does, of course, is to fictionalize it in some ways. Of course, he does that in such an authentic way that his fiction, if picks up and realistically and authentically displays the faith that is his and ours, biblical Christianity, by personifying virtues and evils and making them characters that interact. So we'll talk a little bit more about that toward the end of what I have to say tonight. But John Bunyan's book, Pilgrim's Progress, was written in two parts. And the hymn that we have here and one other hymn, there are only two hymns today that are in common use, much more common use in England actually than here, that come from Pilgrim's Progress. Both of them are from the second part of Pilgrim's Progress, not from the first. And the second part appeared in 1684. How many years before he died? Remember the year? Come on, who's awake?
Four.
Very good. Is that Brother Tom again? No? Okay, good. Just toward the end of his life. But the book was immediately translated. By the time he died, it was in Dutch and German, other Protestant countries. People had begun to read it and translate it and publish it. And very quickly, this book, which was not a personal testimony, and yet was a personal testimony because it arose out of his own deep knowledge of the Bible and his own religious experience, became everyone's story, an expression that people in many different countries related to. There's some dispute about how many languages it's been translated into, kind of like there's a dispute about how many languages the Bible's been translated into, but probably more than, some accounts go up over 200. It's definitely more than 100 languages have this book in their own language. So it is a classic Christian book. It's one of the most important books in the English language for a variety of reasons. And I'm not going to go into all of them, much to your relief tonight. But there are some. And the notion of pilgrim that he picked up, obviously, in that book is one that reminds us, as our songs have every day so far, that we're moving along a pathway, right? We're headed someplace. We're not planting ourselves along the way. And there are purposes along the journey and the encounters that we find, the people we meet, the relationships we form, the experiences we have, all have a bearing on how quickly we progress toward our ultimate goal. All right, so that was the general notion of pilgrim for the Protestant Christian. And Bunyan's setting this up at a time when there was a very different notion of pilgrim that was everywhere in Europe. The idea of pilgrim goes all the way back to the beginning of Christianity. And actually, if you look at the words for pilgrim, and you look at how the word was formed, the words it derived from, and how it evolved over time, one of the most basic words out of which the concept of pilgrim came is a word about a falcon that was a kind of falcon that was very valuable in falconry, but that you could never catch it in its nest. You had to catch it while it was moving. It sprang from its nest, it took off, and you had to catch this bird in flight, and then you could use it. But the notion was, it's moving, and you stop it, you catch it. But the motion is in that early word, that sense of motion. So a pilgrim is somebody going someplace. And, of course, we have that concept in the Bible. I don't need to belabor that point with you tonight at all. You know those verses. But a person who journeys to a sacred place for religious reasons, to honor the place, to honor a person, all religions have those kinds of people, right? You can be a Hindu pilgrim. You can be a Buddhist pilgrim. You can go to sites and places associated with the life of the Buddha. If you're a Hindu, you might go to the Ganges River. If you're a Muslim, you might want to go to Mecca. You're supposed to go to Mecca once in your lifetime. You make pilgrimages to various sites. And so Christians have this too. And it goes back to the beginning, as I said, when it referred to going to see the places where God has chosen to act. We all know people, maybe some of us are such people, who would really like to go to Jerusalem and walk where Jesus walked, right? Or they'd like to stand on the Mount of Olives, or they'd like to go to Egypt and, you know, look at the Nile and think about Moses, or whatever. You want to go where what you read about has happened. And that's a very early impulse in Christianity. And then after people began to be persecuted for their faith, and holy people that many people loved died because of their faith, people would come to honor those people at their burial sites every year on the anniversary of when they died, or maybe more frequently at certain times, or to show their love for God, their devotion, their appreciation for those who had gone before. And in time, this developed into a system for Christians. The natural interest in going to see places associated with holy people and wonderful, miraculous events. And so the graves of the martyrs, or the places associated with the life, especially of Jesus, or biblical events, were very important. Then as the church developed, pilgrimages were difficult, if you think about it. Pilgrimages are not difficult today in most places because you have roads, you have airplanes, you have boats, you have maps, you have cell phones, and you know, you can figure out where you are virtually any place. But early on, it was an extremely difficult thing to be an authentic pilgrim. There were no roads. There were great obstacles to overcome. There weren't geography books that told you exactly what the terrain looked like or what the people you might encounter were like. And some of the most interesting things that you can read out of the Middle Ages are the accounts of people who traveled to holy sites as pilgrims. They wanted to see. They wanted to experience, they wanted to pray at a sacred spot, and they went through all kinds of difficulties to get there. And so the church, many times, used pilgrimages as penance. So, certain people forgot to wash the meat slicer today. So they made a pilgrimage from the ball field to the kitchen to atone for that little problem that they had in their past. And that was a very small example, because you had a road to go on, and if you had friends along the way, you might even have gotten picked up. I don't know about that. But supposing you had sinned and you wanted to show that you were truly sorry. It's not that you had to go on pilgrimage to be forgiven, but you wanted truly to show that you were sorry for your sin. The church would say, okay, take this difficult journey. It might take you a month, 2 months, a year. You know, it could be very difficult. Or, and then there will be an opportunity for you to, for us to believe. We'll believe your repentance is authentic if you're willing to put yourself through this difficulty. And then sometimes there were people who couldn't actually take the pilgrimage, but they wanted to share in the benefits, the blessings of putting yourself through hardship and discipline for Jesus' sake. And so kings would protect pilgrims, or they'd set up little hospices along the way where a pilgrim could find shelter, build a lean-to, provide hospitality. A small group of monks might monitor a place where there might otherwise be danger, or might run a ferry across a fast-flowing river. Other ways that others could participate beside going on the pilgrimage. But the notion of pilgrim is every place. And pilgrims came to wear special garb. There was a pilgrim outfit that showed you were a pilgrim. And this isn't the kind of pilgrim outfit that we think about when we think about the American people we know as pilgrims. This was before that. And then, if you made pilgrimages, you were entitled to wear things on your clothes that showed you'd been there, sort of like a Boy Scout uniform, you know, that shows you did these things. You have your badges. Well, so one thing, pilgrims also were known for a while as palmers, because so many of them went to Jerusalem. If you went to Jerusalem, you were entitled to wear two palms connected to look like a cross. Those were the palmers, or pilgrims, who had been to Jerusalem. So there are all kinds of traditions that come up around the notion of pilgrim. But by the time of John Bunyan, there were many, many people who were abusing this idea of going on pilgrimage and were trying to earn God's favor, or trying to show their holiness by doing this, or using it as if to say, well, I really need to go to this place for God to heal me. I have to pray at this place because that's where God heals people. Or I have to pray for this blessing in this place over here because God did this for somebody else over there. And it was associating God's work with specific places. And very early, the great leaders of the church were warning against that and saying it's wonderful to go, it's wonderful to see and be blessed and remember and think about what happened in different places. But remember, God is every place, and you don't need to go any place in order to find him and have your needs met. So there's this, but the whole idea of pilgrim was something that appealed to people who wanted to do something to show their love for God or earn their salvation, or for whatever reason. Maybe they just had a love of travel and wanted to use pilgrimage as an excuse to get away. And some people accused them of just wanting to get away from their duties and saying, I'll go on a pilgrimage, and just pilgrimage after pilgrimage, and it's all holy, so what can one say about it? And so you skip school, and you never really go to work, and your house is a mess, and you don't really have strong family relationships, but you're earning credits in heaven. So this is the concept of pilgrim. Kings went on pilgrimages all over England. The king, there were pilgrimage sites where every year the king would go on pilgrimage. So it was a very, very big thing that's very difficult for us to imagine. And against that, John Bunyan picks up this notion of pilgrim, which was a very familiar notion but not a notion that many Protestants had developed fully, because they backed away from this Catholic idea of being a pilgrim and earning merits and abusing the whole notion of pilgrimage, even against the teaching of the church. I mean, taking it farther than the church was permitting it. And so against that, the Puritans, of whom, as I said, John Bunyan is one, took the theme of pilgrim and said, no, this is something else. It's not simply finding a place like a Hindu does, where some god did something or some idol is standing. It's actually a metaphor for everyone's life. It's a metaphor, it's an allegory, if you will, it's a way of understanding that helps us realize that we're going someplace when we get all mired down with the troubles of this world. When life seems to overwhelm us, when school's all there is, and you've really got to pass, you know, your Regents or your chemistry exam or whatever you do in California, then that takes over. No, you're headed someplace. We're all pilgrims. And the notion of pilgrim, as he put it, as Bunyan put it, also picked up the theme that we're all equal as pilgrims. You know, you wear the pilgrim garb, as the Roman Catholics did, and they had this something of this theme too, but the pilgrim, there's no shortcut to being a pilgrim. All pilgrims walk. Read Pilgrim's Progress, you know. They all have to make their way over the path. They all have to encounter difficulty. There's no shortcut. There's no way to fast forward and miss parts of this. So this notion of the Pilgrim's Progress is one that's rich for us at camp. I did an informal poll in the kitchen, or I'll just say the palace, so the kitchen doesn't feel singled out, about what comes to mind when you think about the pilgrim and pilgrim camp, and I heard words like Indians, and some people thought about the picture of the gardeners wearing the costume. Some of you have probably seen that picture. We had some very interesting answers along the way, and I think that the way that pilgrim is used here or thought about here really does touch on those things. There is something here that reaches back to the actual people that we know as pilgrims, even though they didn't call themselves pilgrims. We have names on our buildings and names of our rooms that come from Pilgrim's Progress or that commemorate the pilgrims who came in the 1620s and the Puritans who came later in the 1630s and after. So we are connected to that. But I think also in a broader way, we think of pilgrim as a place. I think the Hofflanders have said this somewhat. It's a stopping place along the journey. You know, Pilgrim's Progress has those places too, right? Places where the pilgrim gains refreshment, and in a very real way, pilgrim camp is that kind of a place for many people. And then we also look back to that great classic of literature, Pilgrim's Progress. Now we're going to look at the text, so pull it out. We think about this too. This is a hymn, one of, believe it or not, one of the most famous hymns or frequently sung hymns in English, so the English critics tell us. I actually sang this at Balmoral in Crathy Chapel, watching the Queen and Prince Philip sing it. And the Queen sings everything from memory. She knows all this. But at any rate, so they do sing it. Bunyan is influenced in the Pilgrim's Progress by the Psalms, by the Bible, of course. He wasn't an educated man. He knew the Bible better than most. But that was what he knew, the Bible. And the Psalter, which was the Bible, the Psalms, and other passages put in metrical form so that they could sing it, rhymed, so, or put in meter so it could be easily sung. And so you see that in the Pilgrim's Progress, the influence of that. But I'd like you to look at these stanzas together. Maybe we should read the first one, and then I'll ask you a question about it. So, do I have a volunteer? I keep looking the other way. Zane, would you read me the first stanza, please?
Who would true
valor?
Who would true valor see? Let him come hither.
Mm-hmm.
One hair will constantly come wind, come weather. There's no discouragement shall make him once relent. His first
avowed
intent to be a fulfillment.
I'd like to also look at the ends of the line. See how they rhyme? See, be, hither, weather. They're supposed to rhyme, right? That's what we'd call an A-B-A-B pattern. I see some nods. That's good. Some people know this. So the beginning of this is A-B-A-B. Line A, and then line B, and then line 3 rhymes with A, and line 4 rhymes with B. All right? So now, those are a little awkward in their expression. It's a little unusual form, shall we say, in those first couple lines. But then we get to the next three. And look how they all rhyme with each other. How smooth it becomes. All right, so we have discouragement, relent, intent. Ent, ent, ent. So we have what you might call a CCC, right? You have A, B, A, B, C, C, C. And then you have this extra line. To be a pilgrim. Rhymes with nothing. Stands with itself. By itself. So we have this repeated in each of these stanzas. We always have the same rhyme pattern. And then we have that to be a pilgrim at the very end. Now keep that in mind as we look just really briefly at this. Thought of this song. This song was spoken in a particular circumstance. It was spoken by a man who was given the name Mr. Valiant for the truth. Hyphenated names, nothing new in the 21st century, right? Mr. Valiant for the truth. And he, so it's kind of a dramatic monologue if you think about it that way. It's more dramatic, it's a monologue in ways that most hymns are not. Because that's what it was written to be. But its meaning, its mode of address, the way it is stated, its words and its general meaning make this all capable of being picked up and put to other uses. And so Mr. Valiant for the Truth song becomes a song that all of us can sing. Now, Mr. Valiant for the Truth does one other thing in this poem. He doesn't talk about I, although he could. He puts the whole thing in, I'll ask a question, what person, rather than telling you. What person? I heard it from over here. Third person, Zane, very good. He puts the whole thing in third person, so he's not going to be accused of pride and boasting. So we have this unexpected rhyming scheme here that changes suddenly, and then it ends without in an unrhymed line that helps put emphasis on the conclusion. So this can be seen, I think. I think you can make a case for this. I don't want to be an English teacher for the next half hour, so we can discuss this other times. But there's kind of a roughness at the beginning. The first couple lines are in each stanza are a little more awkward or uncharacteristically stated. And then you get to the regularity, the kind of plainness of the next three lines, and then you get hit with that, to be a pilgrim. All right? And I think one way of looking at this, you know, it depicts, Bunyan is amazingly good at this. It depicts that the both sides of the pilgrim's life, it can be rough. It can be demanding and strenuous. It can also be smooth and plain and very ordinary, very expected. So there can be the unexpected and the expected, as you see in each of these stanzas, just the way the words flow. And then, on those last lines, to be, the verb to be, you know, it's the easiest verb in any language. It's the first one you learn when you study Latin. The first one you learn probably when you study other languages, too. And it's the simplest verb that we have, then the simplest infinitive, followed by one noun. And it really, in one sense, I hope it's interesting to you as it is to me, that it takes all the complexities of the beginning of the poem, all the things, and I'll go over just a few of them in closing, but it simplifies them, it collects them all, they're all gathered up, all the challenges are gathered up and resolved in that line, to be a pilgrim, to be a pilgrim. That's what comes back every time. And so being a pilgrim is both a responsibility and a privilege. It's a lot of work. Bunyan puts it, he'll labor night and day to be a pilgrim. So the poem that we sang here, and we're not going to take time to read the rest of it here. I know you read it on day one. I hope you'll reread it again and think about it maybe as the way it's put together as we're talking tonight. But it's a... it deviates from the natural patterns of speech, even of that time, at the beginning, in the first part of each verse. It comes closer to more natural speech in the middle of each stanza, and then ending with a completely natural statement to be a pilgrim. We all understand that. It's a sentence that doesn't seem out of order, the words all, you know, to be a pilgrim. We would talk that way. And the state of being a pilgrim here is one that has demands in this hymn, as you see it. It has rewards. You can be proud of being a pilgrim. He will have a right to be a pilgrim. It's a privilege to be a pilgrim, not just simply a duty. And so the state of being a pilgrim, the privilege of being a pilgrim, belongs to every Christian. As we appropriate this metaphor, which I hope that you will find as a rich way of expanding our understanding of what it's like to be a Christian, what it means to be a Christian. Because our language is finite, because we can't really find words sometimes to say all that we want to say, we use metaphors like this to help us put it better, to show some of the rich texture that's there that we might otherwise miss. I think Bunyan's triumph, you know, this is an arduous undertaking to be a pilgrim, and that Bunyan understood this. The thing that makes Pilgrim's Progress a classic, and that makes this song an enduring song, is that it understands and it commits to us the notion that to be a pilgrim is a privilege, to be a pilgrim is an arduous task. It demands all that we have if we want to be a pilgrim, that simple line at the end. And so pilgrim is one word into which a lot of rich Christian understanding and teaching can be packed, and in which it has been over the years. And just a couple more words here. You find words of confidence in this poem. Shall life inherit, will have right, his strength the more is, he'll fear not, he'll labor. And then there are denied, what you call denied negatives. No discouragement, no hobgoblin, nor foul fiend, no lion. You know, if you take all of that together, the positives and the negatives, it's if you will, a comprehensive defense and an attack. You know, you're defending and you're attacking at the same time here. The defense in each stanza gives way to confidence as you go on walking as a pilgrim. You're more confident in your walk. He'll fear not what men say. He'll labor night and day to be a pilgrim. So, evils, discouragements, giants, hobgoblins, whatever, are all reminders that the pilgrim's life is difficult here. And the book, of course, will illustrate that. I'm sure the movie does too, Jacob, right? It's difficult at every turn. But it's juxtaposed to false valor. We have true valor here. Who would true valor see? Let him come hither. And this word is an important word too, and I'll close with that. As opposed to courage, which could have been used, it was a more common English word, this is really an Anglo-French word that's associated with chivalry. So who would true knights, valor? Think about it, right? So there's a careful choice of words here. And we have from a man who was a tinker, a Baptist preacher imprisoned for his choice of place to worship and how to go about it. One of the great classics that has lived on since was instantly recognized for what it was, that has enriched the lives of many, many people, and you know, even if you never get around to reading it all, you could try to remember Mr. Valiant for Truth's song as a summary of the dangers, the work, and the joys and the privileges of being pilgrims.